It's The Takeaway. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, host of WNYC and NPR's Consider This, in for Tanzina Vega. Tanzina is back with you tomorrow. Good to be with you today. This month, lawmakers in New York State approved a historic $2.1 billion, that's billion with a B, relief fund for undocumented workers and others with non-traditional jobs that have been shut out from government relief. The Excluded Workers Fund, as it's being called, was established as part of New York State budget's negotiations. It's the most expansive fund of its kind in the U.S. and will provide much-needed relief for nearly 300,000 people who've been excluded from both state and federal assistance, like stimulus checks and unemployment benefits, because of their immigration status. Undocumented workers are among the hardest hit by the COVID-19 pandemic, and with a new relief fund, they can receive up to $15,600 if they're able to prove their New York residency and loss of income, among other things. The creation of the Excluded Workers Fund follows weeks of protests demanding lawmakers to include relief for undocumented workers in the New York State budget, including a three-week hunger strike in Manhattan. But will New York be the exception to the rule, or could we see pandemic relief for undocumented workers in other states next? Let's talk about it. For more on this, we're joined now by Emerita Torres, Vice President of Policy Research and Advocacy at the Community Service Society of New York. Emerita, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Rebecca.
Also with us is Josefa Velasquez, senior reporter for The City, a nonprofit news organization based in New York City. Josefa, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Rebecca. Thanks for having me on.
Josefa, let's start with you. How significant is New York's Excluded Workers Fund?
So, I mean, it's huge. To compare it to California, which had a fund created last year, California's disaster relief fund for undocumented individuals was only $125 million. Here we're talking about a program that is $2.1 billion with a B, where undocumented and excluded workers who didn't qualify for the federal financial assistance or state benefits are going to be able to really tap into this pool of money. It's the first program of its kind in New York, in the state, and federally.
And Josefa, remind us of the toll the pandemic took on New York's undocumented population.
So when the pandemic began, you know, at this point a year ago, a lot of people lost their jobs. Fortunately, there were some safety net systems in place, but not for undocumented workers. At one point, experts estimated that more than half of the city's immigrants were unemployed and unable to tap into unemployment benefits or get any federal stimulus payments. So I think, as you had mentioned, we could be seeing up to 300,000 New Yorkers who might be eligible for this type of aid. That is a tremendous number of people that might be getting resources for the first time in the last year.
And Emerita, let's get more specific. Who are the people who will most benefit from this fund?
So this fund is going to support undocumented workers and non-traditional workers who haven't received the dime in federal state aid. As you mentioned, these are drivers, domestic workers, street vendors, car mechanics, and you know, those who have really been unseen in our economy, but who are the hardest working and have really taken a hit throughout this pandemic. 54% of immigrants are essential workers. So they've been holding down really the fort of the economy in New York for some time.
And Emerita, this isn't just for undocumented people, but for other low-income people left out of relief packages, right?
That's correct. So other non-traditional workers as well. One thing to note is that, you know, at the last minute during the budget negotiations, there was a lot of discussion about including formerly incarcerated individuals, of which there are about 40,000 in New York. However, that was actually cut out of the Excluded Workers Fund. So that's unfortunate because formerly incarcerated individuals have been left now with dismal employment prospects as the state battles through the pandemic-related recession.
And Josefa, how exactly did this fund get established? I mean, was it something that was being pushed for last year, or is this more recent?
So it's more recent. When the legislative session started in January, there had been a push to create a $3.5 billion excluded workers fund. But it's hard to sell that to a legislature where people represent a variety of areas of New York as a standalone proposal. So it got baked into the state's $212 billion budget. And the reason it's important to have it in there is because the state budget has something for everyone. So while you might not be supportive of the excluded workers fund in particular, there might be something else in the state's budget that benefits your constituents or your district. So it makes it more palatable when it's tucked away into, you know, this massive financial plan.
And Josefa, how effective, based on your reporting, were the recent hunger strikes in getting lawmakers to create this fund, in pushing them to do this?
It definitely added focus to this measure. I think it was a couple of things. The hunger strike, certainly, and the amount of press that got, but also it the change in the legislature overall, which has been a long time coming. You suddenly have this year a supermajority in both chambers. So not only do you have enough Democrats to pass, you know, more progressive measures, you have enough people that if the governor were to veto it, they can override that veto. Mm-hmm. But also a new wave of, you know, more progressive lawmakers who are willing to push for these measures that, you know, maybe last year they wouldn't have done so.
Emerita, the New York Fund creates this two tiers, you know, a two-tier system that will pay out different amounts to those who are eligible. Why is that important? And maybe explain a little bit about these two different payments.
Sure. So the fund targets, in terms of a time frame, between March 2020 and April 2021. So 13 months, 13 months where excluded workers didn't receive a dime of aid. Tier one, if you're in tier one, for example, you would have to show a sizable amount of documentation. For example, proof that you filed taxes, proof of an individual, or, you know, showing an individual tax ID number, proof of residency. And this can also, you know, be, you can also provide a letter from an employer to show that you had a loss of income. And in doing that, you could get upwards of $15,600. This is a huge figure. It's roughly equivalent to employment insurance. It would be retroactive. So again, you would get payments from, you know, back from March 2020. And tier two is where, you know, an undocumented or excluded worker would provide less documentation. It doesn't have, you know, a tax ID number or other forms of documentation. It means less money, so it would be around $3,200, which is equivalent to around three rounds of stimulus checks that they would have received. And you'd have to prove, for example, your residency, your identity, and some kind of alternative proof of eligibility. This was a big deal during negotiations. It's hard for excluded workers to provide proof of income. For example, if you're working, you know, shelving at a bodega, if you are a car mechanic or an assistant to a car mechanic, you don't have pay stubs, you don't have bank accounts. So this was a really critical issue during the budget negotiations.
And Emerita, because many of the people who qualify are undocumented, are there safeguards in place to protect, you know, any documentation or records they submit from ICE or Customs and Border Protection?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, according to Immigrant and Customs Enforcement, can they get your documents? The law specifically states that any person or entity who receives or has access to records that certify information will not be used for civil immigration purposes. So that it's a violation. It's a Class A misdemeanor. However, you know, it is a concern for many undocumented workers. I mean, we've seen the rhetoric and the actions of the former administration, the Trump administration. So this is going to be a real factor in undocumented excluded workers providing this documentation. So it's going to be really important to do outreach and to make sure that workers are comfortable providing this information.
Josefa, a key part of this will be how these funds are actually distributed and administered. So do we know what that looks like? And what should people know in order to apply for these funds? How can they do it?
So while there's a lot of information of what you may need, there's still a giant question mark in place because it's going to be up to the state's Department of Labor to come up with the process. So we're talking about the application and any additional documents that they might want to add to, you know, the qualifying documents for either tier one or tier two. So it could be months before we start seeing, you know, money going out the door. But in the meantime, there are a lot of document requirements for the first tier. And this, you know, runway that they're being given before money starts being dispersed is time where you can start putting those documentations together. So we're talking about, you know, an unexpired passport. You can go to your consulate and try to get one of those if you don't have one, or a consulate issued ID card, any sort of taxes that you may have filed with an ITIN in the last couple of years, bank statements or letters from employers, those all count towards the application requirements. So, you know, like I said, it's going to be probably a couple of months until we get to see what the process is like. Mm. It's enough time, though, for people to start getting everything that they might need in order to be eligible.
And Amrita, we are running out of time, but in the, 40 seconds we have left, in addition to these funds, what else do undocumented workers need as this pandemic continues on?
Mm-hmm. So one thing that the budget failed to do is it failed to offer any coverage at all for COVID-19 infected undocumented immigrants. Mm. So this is something that we have to keep in mind. The way that we're supporting excluded workers on, economic stimulus, we need to do the same around healthcare. We need to do the same around workforce development. There's a probability that a lot of excluded workers might be shut out of the workforce because they work in face-to-face industries that may be replaced over time because of remote work and automation and the like. So it's going to be really important to support a just and equitable recovery that works for all New Yorkers, where no one is excluded.
Amrita Torres is the Vice President of Policy, Research, and Advocacy at the Community Service Society of New York, and Josefa Velasquez is Senior Reporter for the City. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Over the past 2 weeks, negotiations have taken place in Vienna between Iran and officials from other nations still signed onto the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Diplomats from the U.S. are also in the city to negotiate a potential re-entry into the deal, but so far have not sat down face-to-face with the Iranian representatives. After several days of talks, both the U.S. and Iran indicated that discussions were moving in a positive direction. But an explosion at an Iranian nuclear facility on Monday could derail negotiations. Iran's government has been tight-lipped about the full extent of the damage at the facility, but multiple outlets are reporting that Israel was involved in the attack. And while the Israeli government has not officially confirmed their role, Iranian officials are vowing retaliation in response to the explosion. This all leaves the Biden administration in a complicated position, since its close alliance with Israel could make Iran more resistant to negotiating with the U.S. Here's what White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters about the situation on Monday.
We, of course, have seen the reports of the incident at the Natanz enrichment facility. The U.S. was not involved. In any manner, we have nothing to add on speculation about the causes or the impacts. I will say on your first question, though, we are focused on the discussions that we expect to proceed this Wednesday in Vienna, to the diplomatic discussions that have been taking place and took place last week. We expect them to be difficult and long. We have not been given any indication about a change in participation for these discussions.
Here with us now is Golnaz Esfandiari, a senior correspondent with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, who covers Iran. Welcome back to the show, Golnaz.
Thank you for having me.
What information have Iranian officials put out so far about the explosion?
Well, first they said there was a power outage at the Natanz nuclear facility, which is a nuclear base in central Iran, and it's underground. Later they said there was an explosion. A spokesperson with the country's nuclear atomic energy agency said it was a small explosion, and that the explosion caused some damage. But as you said, we don't know exactly the extent of the damage at Natanz. There were reports, and the New York Times cited two intelligence sources saying that the operations there had been set back for at least 9 months. But Iranian official claimed that the outage has been fixed and that they're replacing the damaged centrifuges with more advanced machines. Today, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif spoke about the incident, and he also said that that Natanz is going to move forward with more advanced centrifuges in the near future.
And what is the significance of the nuclear site that was attacked this week?
Well, this is a key nuclear site in Iran. Iran uses it for uranium enrichment and is underground. And this site was also targeted in the past. Last July, Iranian officials reported a fire at Natanz, and later they said that the cause of the fire was a sabotage act, and they blamed again Israel, saying that Israel was involved in that incident. And Natanz has been also hit by cyber attacks in the past by Stuxnet, so it's not the first time that it's been targeted.
And Golnaz, at the moment, how much do we know about Israel's involvement in the explosion?
Well, as you said, Israel has not confirmed nor denied any role in this incident. But intelligence sources, unnamed intelligence sources, have been quoted by Israeli media as saying that Mossad was behind this latest incident. But I don't think that Israel, has a policy of not confirming or denying having a hand in these actions. But we know, that Israel has been accused also in the past of actions that are aimed at delaying or damaging Iran's nuclear program, which Israel sees as an existential threat. So there were, as I said, there was this fire in Natanz. There's been the assassination of an Iranian nuclear scientist. A top nuclear scientist was killed last year, last November, near the capital, Tehran. And again, Iranian official pointed the accusation finger at Israel.
So tell us more what Iranian officials have said they're going to do in response to this attack.
Well, today, Iranian foreign minister said that Iran will retaliate if it determines that Israel was indeed behind this attack. But even before that, some said that, Iran should take revenge. We've heard from the hardliners. For example, there was an op-ed piece in the hardline news agency Tasnim, which is close to the powerful Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, and that it called for Iran to leave the nuclear talks, saying that they're taking place under the shadow of terror, because Iranian officials have called this latest attack on Natanz nuclear terrorism. Others said that, Iran should retaliate, but they said that not for now, that Iran should remain in the talks, and that leaving the talks is actually what Israel would want. As you know, Israel has opposed the nuclear deal and the aims of these talks. This is an attempt to basically revive the nuclear deal by getting the U.S. to rejoin and Iran to come back into full compliance.
And what has the Biden administration said about the attack?
The Biden administration had said that it didn't play any role in this attack. It distanced itself and said it remains focused on the nuclear talks that started last week in Vienna and are due to resume later this week again. These talks are the first time that the Iranian side and the representatives from the Biden administration are holding indirect negotiations. The European countries are working as intermediaries between the two sides. And looks like the talks are very complicated and they're very difficult, and it could take months or weeks. We don't know. But it seems that there wasn't any breakthrough yet. But all participants said that the atmosphere was constructive.
So, Golnaz, what's the likelihood of this attack making it more difficult for the U.S. and Iran to reach an agreement regarding the nuclear deal?
Well, I don't think that this means the end of the talks in Vienna, but it's likely that it's going to make it more difficult. It's going to make it more difficult because it's going to make it less likely that Iran will be willing to compromise. There are already people in Iran saying, you know, that there's no way that the U.S. didn't know about this attack, that, you know, they claim that Israel had coordinated with the U.S. or had at least given advance warning to the U.S. that this is going to happen. So in that sense, the talks, which are already very difficult and complicated, could become more complicated. But for now, the two sides seems to be, you know, willing to go back to Vienna and just see if they can reach an agreement. And for that, both sides would need to be pragmatic. You know, we can't expect Iran to get everything that it wants, and the same for the U.S. So there are tough days ahead, I think.
And looking beyond the attack, what have been some of the sticking points when it comes to the U.S. agreeing to reenter the nuclear deal?
Well, Iran has been calling for the lifting of all the sanctions that the Trump administration put in place after leaving the 2015 nuclear deal. There are about, I think, the Iranian deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, who is the chief negotiator, said there are about 1,500 designations. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a very complex task to undo all these sanctions. And also, it's not clear if the U.S. is willing to basically remove all the sanctions. The U.S. is likely to want to have some leverage, you know, over Iran. But it seems that they're on the right path. I think what's going to be very difficult is that the Biden administration has expressed interest in making this deal longer and stronger. And that's going to be a major problem, I think. That's because I don't think Iran would be willing to talk about its missile program and also its regional ambitions.
And you mentioned sanctions. Why is sanctions relief so important to Iran?
Iran's economy is in dire straits. These sanctions have crippled the Iranian economy. Iran cannot sell its oil, or it's been very difficult for Iran to sell its oil, which is a major source of outcome for the country. There's also growing frustration on the part of Iranians who took to the streets last November because the government suddenly increased the price of petrol. And that angered very many people who said the poor is going to become even poorer. The government responded with force, killing a few hundred people, even some of those who were not basically participating in the protests. So there's lots of tensions in Iran. And as I said, the economy is in a very bad shape, and they definitely need sanctions relief. And they're also facing a fourth wave of the pandemic. The number of people who are dying every day is increasing very fast. Today it was nearly 200 people, 291, which is the highest in weeks. So, you know, the situation is very bad, and they need to be able to sell their oil. They need the sanctions to be lifted.
Golnaz Esfandiari is a senior correspondent with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, who covers Iran. Thank you so much, Golnaz.
Thanks for having me.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the weekend, Kim Potter, a police officer in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, a suburb of Minneapolis, fatally shot Dante Wright, a 20-year-old black man, during a traffic stop. This all unfolded minutes from where George Floyd was killed last year and amid the ongoing trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer facing charges in Floyd's death. Demonstrators gathered almost instantly to mourn the death of Dante Wright and to demand police accountability.
Don't shoot!
During a press conference on Monday, Brooklyn Center Police Chief Tim Gannon told the media that Officer Potter, who's been on the force 26 years, intended to draw her taser, but instead drew her service weapon.
This appears to me, from what I viewed and the officer's reaction in distress immediately after, that this was an accidental discharge.
For more on this recent killing and what's happening on the ground, we're joined by Nina Moyney, a reporter at Minnesota Public Radio News. Nina, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Rebecca.
Nina, let's start with what we know so far. Why was Dante Wright pulled over in the first place?
Well, according to the Brooklyn Center Police Department, they say that they pulled him over. This was in the middle of the afternoon on Sunday for expired tabs. In Minnesota, we have little stickers that really clearly indicate by year and color if your tabs are expired or not. Mm-hmm. The family of Dante Wright, his mother, Katie Wright, says that he was pulled over for having an air freshener displayed in his vehicle from his rearview mirror, which that is a law in the state that you're not supposed to have something hanging from there that could, you know, obscure the sight or anything like that. Police say that that's something that they discovered after they had pulled him over and when they went up to the car.
And what do we know about what happened during the stop?
We know what the police have shown us via the body camera footage. We weren't able to see all of it. It was a clip, and it shows officers approaching the vehicle. It shows officer, who's now been identified as Kim Potter, eventually drawing her gun, we now know, instead of her taser, as Dante Wright was re-entering his vehicle and sitting down in a seated position in the driver's seat. And you hear her say, "Taser," multiple times. And then you hear the gun. And then you hear her say an expletive and say, "I just shot him."
Yeah. And as we heard in the intro clip, the police chief said he believes this was an accidental discharge because Kim Potter, the officer, meant to fire her taser. But how has the community responded to that?
Well, they say it's just absolutely unacceptable that a mistake like that is something that is born out of community members, say, somebody already having a prejudice and bias. And one community member here who has been in the community for years and who organizes a lot said yesterday that he feels that Dante Wright was dead before he was even pulled over. So almost immediately after the news broke, many people in the community were demanding that this officer be immediately fired. We understand that she has not been fired, that she's on a administrative leave as a standard procedure. And Chief Gannon stood by that and said that everybody deserves a due process. But this was very upsetting to the Wright family and many people in the community.
Nina, this happened so close to where Derek Chauvin killed George Floyd, and emotions are already heightened. So what are you seeing there on the ground?
The last year has been extremely traumatic for the people of the Twin Cities and the people of the state. And I think people who don't live here maybe don't realize what a force and what a presence George Floyd still is in the community. You know, we have rubble in the streets of Minneapolis still from businesses that were damaged during some unrest that haven't been rebuilt yet. There are images of George Floyd and murals of him and signs in people's yards and in people's windows. So this trauma never really ended. And then the trial began, and that conjured up a lot of trauma for a lot of people, particularly our Black residents here in the Twin Cities area. So to have something like this happen was almost unbelievable and very shocking, and then stunning to have it turn out that police say that it was just an accident that just happened. The timing of it is just remarkable. And it has led to, as we've all seen now, more unrest, more protests. And it's something that law enforcement, you know, top law enforcement officials in the state had already been prepared for a heightened police presence because of the Chauvin trial. The National Guard was already on standby. They didn't want to see more destruction happen and, you know, made it clear to everybody that they're fine with peaceful protests, but that they're going to put a stop to any sort of damage or looting and rioting. But we've already seen within the past couple of days that some looting and rioting has taken place, and a few dozen businesses, at least that we know of, have been damaged significantly.
And has this latest police-involved killing affected the Chauvin trial at all?
Well, we know that attorney Eric Nelson, Chauvin's attorney, did ask that the jury be sequestered almost immediately. We know that Judge Peter Cahill denied that request and said that they're going to be sequestered anyway during jury deliberations. This was also something that really struck a nerve and upset a lot of people in the community. They felt like it was another effort by the defense, they say, to try to sort of throw a wrench in the trial, or another sort of desperate attempt, they say, to try to make this something it wasn't, when they say that it was very clear in the videos what happened to George Floyd.
Nina Moyney is a reporter for NPR News and co-host of In Front of Our Eyes, a podcast about the Chauvin trial and the life of George Floyd. Nina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This month, an unretouched and unauthorized photo of reality star Khloe Kardashian standing poolside in a bikini was posted to Instagram. Kardashian and her team scrambled to take the photo off social media, reigniting a conversation about the unrealistic beauty standards that celebrities like the Kardashians have perpetuated and monetized while publicly embracing, quote, body positivity. Over the years, the myth that one standard of beauty fits all has waned, and the so-called body positivity movement has gained momentum in the mainstream. But what started as a movement meant to center the marginalized bodies of fat people has been co-opted by affluent, thin, white women as a means to celebrate themselves. We're joined now by Charlotte Zoller, writer of the column Ask a Fat Girl for Teen Vogue. Charlotte, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Ivy Felicia, a certified holistic wellness coach and body image expert. Hey.
Hi.
Charlotte, let's start with this incident. In her explanation for wanting the photo removed, Khloe Kardashian said in a statement, quote, "It's almost unbearable trying to live up to the impossible standards that the public have all set for me." Now, without negating Khloe's feelings, does she not carry some of the responsibility for bolstering that impossible standard of beauty to begin with?
Yeah, you know, the Kardashians have profited off body positivity while at the same time perpetuating, as you said, those unrealistic beauty standards. And Khloe specifically actually has used body positivity to her profit. You know, she has a size inclusive denim company called Good American, which says, you know, it's committed to challenging industry norms and is 100% inclusive always. And, you know, she's using this body positivity for profit while without the penalties and discrimination that come along with being in a marginalized body.
And how do you square outwardly projecting perfection and posting heavily filtered or photoshopped photos and then purporting to support body positivity or size inclusivity?
Yeah, well, her response to this photo was a missed opportunity to lead by example. You know, she's in a position of power where she could authentically show up as herself, but has chosen not to. And that sends a signal to her followers and who are also her customers, to be perfectly honest.
So Ivy, you call yourself the body relationship coach. How does this incident with Khloe Kardashian that we've been talking about fit into conversations about, quote, body positivity today?
I feel that it's the body positivity movement has definitely become watered down. Mm-hmm. I think because we've taken our eyes and our focus off of the original intent, and the people who were coming from this space of a lived experience, which I think was mentioned in the conversation earlier, mm-hmm. That makes all the difference, right? And I think it becomes problematic when we start to censor people and uphold people who don't even hold the same values that this movement was originally created for. So, of course, they're going to make decisions that are somewhat off kilter and don't necessarily align with the purpose of, hey, let's center marginalized people and let's make sure that we are thinking about when we post pictures, when we post captions, let's make sure that we're thinking about those people when we do those things. So I don't think that it's any coincidence that these types of things happen because we're centering the wrong people.
Mm. And you said the original purpose of the movement. So how did this movement start off?
Well, it started off with centering marginalized people who were in larger bodies, Black and people of color. Originally started this movement and originally started the fat acceptance, fat activism concept. And then it's something that became watered down, and sort of people who were fat got pushed into mm-hmm. the margins, right? And got decensored. And mm-hmm. so, you know, if you're fat and you live in a fat body, you've lived in a marginalized body like I do, you know what it feels like to be erased, to be pushed into the margins. You have that lived experience always inside of you. So sometimes when you're making decisions, those things help to remind you how to show up in public and the things that you do. So I think that when we have people who have pretty privilege, who have socioeconomic status, they're mm-hmm. thinking in those interests, right? They're not thinking in the interests of the people who are watching, the people who are struggling with their bodies, the people who are struggling with their body image.
Right. So then, Charlotte, you know, hearing all this, has body positivity become then a buzzword, or does it still have meaning?
You know, body positivity has been a lifeline for those who struggle with mental health and body dysmorphia, eating disorders and more, and everyone can benefit from it, but definitely echoing the fact that it was rooted, rooted in the fat acceptance movement that, fast forward 60 years, those radicalized, radical ideas have been distilled down pretty far now.
And you know, Ivy, Fat Sigma has deep roots in misogyny and racism, right? So what can you tell us about that?
Absolutely, because fat stigma, fat phobia, they come as a result of the patriarchy. They come as a result of racism. And so they actually are showing up now in body positivity because it is starting, it's marginalizing the people it was meant to save and to help and to support at the beginning.
Charlotte, what happened as body positivity became part of the mainstream discourse on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok? And speaking from personal experience, I'm a 33-year-old woman, so I'm grown, hopefully, but I still go through Instagram and TikTok and have to catch myself, from thinking, oh, my body is not enough. So, what have those apps been good for the movement?
I think that's a great question. It goes both ways. Social media can, and specifically Instagram and TikTok, can help hurt or help your body image. It really just depends on what corner of the internet you're in. Hmm. It's an amazing tool to normalize bodies and to see bodies that look like your own, but you have to be following them first.
Mm-hmm. And Ivy, online we've seen thin individuals spread messages of body positivity alongside photos of themselves, while pointing out things about their bodies that they don't love. So has the body positivity movement in a way been co-opted or maybe confused with just self-love?
I do feel like it's everyone's right to love their body, to celebrate their body, to post pictures of their body. I think it becomes problematic when we don't have a diverse group that we're taught that's being represented. And that then it starts to look like one body, right? Over and over again. I think that's what we're talking about, even in social media, that, you know, because of the algorithms and just kind of how things have been calculated, we're not seeing a diverse group of bodies. So therefore, it looks like body positivity is only one type of body. And so therefore, it is starting to be correlated with, oh, this is what self-love looks like. But I think if you can intentionally curate your own feed, which is what was also mentioned earlier, if you can curate your own feed and create diversity in your own feed, you can have a much more diverse, deeper, and more supportive experience with body positivity, body image, fat acceptance, all of that.
And Ivy, I want to talk about, you know, the growth of body positivity. But the thing is, we as a society continue to associate thin bodies with hard work and health. Why is it so hard to dispel that notion?
It's intentional. It's intentional, right? Because if we go back to what we were talking about, racism and patriarchy, if one type of person, which would be, you know, thin, affluent white males, is what beauty standards have been built by, and then it centers thin, affluent, socioeconomically empowered white women, have been put at the forefront of the conversation. So when you have those people as the foundation of the movement, of course, it's intentional to marginalize anything that doesn't look like that. And so if we believe that Black people, people of color, are lazy and not hardworking, if we believe that fat people are lazy and not hardworking and unhealthy, and we build an understanding and a movement around those beliefs, then we start to perpetuate that, right? So now there's the concept of, oh, you know, people of color or fat people of color are both lazy and unintelligent and not hardworking. And so then the movement starts to align with that as well.
Charlotte, for years, influencers and celebrities, including the Kardashians, have used Instagram to market and sell products like waist trainers and flat tummy tea to their audiences. So what does that mean to the millions of people who follow them, particularly young and impressionable people?
Yeah, I mean, Khloé and her sisters have promoted products, just like you said, you know, waist trainers and appetite suppressant lollipops. And that does send a potent message to their followers, which is that you're not okay the way you are, the body you're in. You know, we live in a society that holds thin, white, abled people above all others. And I think there's also a real disconnect here between promoting health and promoting weight loss. You know, the diet industry is extremely profitable. In 2020 alone, the U.S. weight loss market was valued at $71 billion, which gives you just, you know, at how big of an indication that how deeply diet culture and fat phobia are ingrained in our society.
And you say diet industry, but in a way, what I hear now is wellness industry, right? But it all seems very, you know, thinly veiled diet.
They're becoming pretty interchangeable, which is upsetting and concerning. Yeah.
So brands, Ivy, have also jumped on the fact that there's a huge demand to see more than one type of beauty standard showcased. So has the, quote, body positivity movement been commodified to a certain extent, Ivy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when brands are more focused on sort of trying to appear, right, to be progressive, and to go with a trend rather than actually changing what they're doing and who they're showing and why, I think that's when it becomes problematic, because we still see them kind of staying close to that same body type, although they might have someone who's a little bit bigger, you know, or they might bring in some color. You know, what we really need to think about is how do we bring the most marginalized people into this representation? And then also, what does it mean to change the socioeconomic state of these people that they're bringing in with brands? Like, you know, what does it mean to pay them well? You know, what does it mean to hire them consistently, not just to be pretty pictures, but to actually be influencers and to be part of the brand and part of the team that creates the products that they have?
And lastly, how can well-meaning individuals who have used the body positivity and self-love movements interchangeably be better allies to those with marginalized bodies? Ivy, I'll start with you.
Sure. I think that what people can do is, first of all, listen to people with marginalized voices, right, was what I say. Listen to those people, listen to their lived experiences, listen to their knowledge. And then secondly, I would say to amplify those voices, right? So amplify the things that you hear, the things that you listen to, the things that you learn, amplify that into your community, out to your friends, in your board and in your companies. And thirdly, I would say compensate, hire those voices and those people, right? So it's not just about taking, listening, and learning and amplifying, but also making sure that you're giving back to those people and that you're actually helping to elevate them, their socioeconomic status as well.
Charlotte?
Yes. Piggybacking on what Ivy said about listening to fat folks, I think, unfortunately, there is no easy one solution to this issue, or even just one way to be an ally here. You know, I think it's really looking internally and looking at your own internal anti-fat bias, because, you know, we all have bias. That's not the issue. It's what we do with our bias that is the important thing. So I think specifically around health, challenging the notion that someone doesn't need to be healthy or prove their health to you to deserve respect.
Charlotte Zoeller is the writer of the column Ask a Fat Girl for Teen Vogue, and Ivy Felicia is a certified holistic wellness coach and body image expert. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you very much.
That's the show, folks. So wonderful to be here with you guys today. Tanzina is back in the chair tomorrow, and we'd love to hear from you guys. So keep calling us with thoughts or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also tweet to me at Rebe Ibarra C. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, and this is The Takeaway.